Hello?
Yeah.
Ah, okay, let's do it again. Hello friends. I'm Roman. So let's start with an overview. I'm scratchy too, right? Okay. A little overview and motivation why we are doing all this. So what is Project Lilliput? Let's start at the beginning. It's an open JDK project. It's a community project. We get contributions by Red Hat, Oracle, SAP, Huawei, Alibaba, Amazon, that's me. The goal of that project is to reduce memory footprint of Java applications in a Java heap. As a side effect of that goal, we will also see potential CPU and latency improvements. Specifically, we want to achieve these heap memory reductions by reducing the size of Java object headers. To illustrate this, let's consider a hypothetical very small Java heap with So let's look at this hypothetical Java heap. Each of these squares represents a Java object with different sizes. And in such a heap, we would have like everything that is yellow here is object headers. This is really just metadata for the VM, like class information and some other stuff. I will get into this. And yeah, this means we waste quite a lot of memory on just this metadata in the heap. With Project Lilliput, the goal is, so if we consider each of these like as half of those squares, one word, we want to like reduce these, cut in half, might look end up looking like this, with much less metadata for each object, and we free up a lot of space there at the bottom. So this is the savings. Another way to look at this is to see the breakdown of metadata versus actual payload. And in I did some statistics when I started this project, so around 20% of live data on the heap is actually only metadata in the object headers. This depends a lot on the workload. So if some workloads, they have much more of this. Some workloads, they have much less ratio here. But this is kind of an average. So this is the current situation where we have headers that are 12 bytes large. With Project Lilliput, in the first step, we want to go to 8-byte headers. Which means that the ratio of metadata here is only like 13% on average. Your mileage may vary again. Average savings of around 7-10% up to maybe 30 or even a little bit more percent here. The long-term goal with Lilliput is to have headers that are only 4 bytes large. And if you achieve this, then only 6% of live data is object headers, and savings up to like 50% compared to the current situation. We did that already. We did most of the work already, and we run some services at Amazon already with Lilliput. And this is the heap usage of the service after GC. When Lilliput was deployed, it dropped by about 30%. I must admit that this is a bit of a sweet spot case. So not all workloads look like this, but it shows quite well how this works. As a side effect of this, the CPU utilization also dropped by about 25% here when Lilliput got deployed. So this was quite. Is it still on? Okay. So this was quite significant, and this has the effect on latency too. Latency drops by some percent. So, motivation part. Helpfully, Alexi, who did the GOL thing. So, if you have a workload and want to know how would it look like when running Lilliput, you can generate a heap dump with your workload and then run it through GOL tool, which is here, and you can get some nice estimates of your heap utilization with different configuration, including Lilliput. To tell you, you would save, like, I don't know, so, such and such percent with Lilliput. And it can even do the crystal ball and look into the future and tell you about Lilliput 2. That's because the heap dumps don't actually include the metadata. The GOL tool needs to do a lot of calculations and estimations and come up with something. But it's pretty useful. At the end of the day, what does it do? It reduces your hardware or cloud cost. You can save on instance cost here. You can do the same hardware and drive more load on it. You can help reduce your energy bills and save CO2 for the climate. So this is all good. Let's look into what's going on there. D-object headers. This is a breakdown of the current situation. So we have one word at the beginning of each object, which we call the mark word for historical reasons. It's really just a header that contains stuff. And we have 64 bits, and 2 bits here, they are tag bits or log bits. They indicate what the rest of those bits mean. Usually they mean we have GCH bits here, 4 bits of GCH 0 to 15, and then we have hash code bits. When you call the identity hash code of an object, this will generate some number and stick it here. And then you have some unused bits up here. Okay, and the next word, the second word of each object, contains the class pointer, the class, so-called class pointer. It points to the internal structures in Hotspot that tells you all about the class of that object. Usually what you get with modern JVMs is the compressed class pointer, which is 32 bits. I don't want to talk about the other one. Thomas is going to talk about a lot of details, how to deal with that. But this means that the first two words of each object are taken by metadata. For many objects, we can start sticking actual payload in these other 32 bits here. For arrays, we can put the array length there, but yeah. What we want to do is, you can probably see this already. We have the class pointer here. We have free space here. We can probably stick it in there and then see how to deal with the other bits there. Problem is, what we also have is the so-called displaced headers or overloaded headers. This happens when locking happens or DHCC does some things. And then the tag bit here will indicate what the rest of those bits mean, and usually it's a native pointer to some structure. So, and this means that those bits up here, they are not actually always unused. They are only sometimes unused, and yeah. This is a major problem. I get into how we want to deal with this. We still have to compress class pointers there. As an example, when this happens is when we have a stack-locked object, then the tag bits is 00. The rest of it is a pointer onto the stack. Then we have objects that are locked by an object monitor. Then we have those tag bits, and this is a pointer to some object monitor structure that lives somewhere. Or the GC can use this for storing forwarding information, and it points. So then we have this tag bit here, 1-1, and it points to the forwarded object in somewhere else in the heap. This may look like this. Like in the example of an object monitor, we have exactly the situation that I just talked about. If that happens, where's the original mark word? Say we have some hash code here, and so we need to preserve it somewhere. Its answer is usually it's in the for example in the object monitor case, it's displaced in the beginning of the object monitor structure. This is fiddly stuff. So the plan is to get here for the first step that we are currently working on. So we would still have the tag bits here, or maybe not. Then we have another bit here that says about self-forwarding. Then we have H bits here, some unused stuff, and the identity hash code, and a few bits for the class pointer. If you count this correctly, those are not 32 bits like we had before, that those are fewer bits. Thomas is going to talk about how we do this. The long-term plan for Lilliput, we call this Lilliput 2 already, is squeeze everything into 32 bits. We still have those tag bits here, self-forwarding pointer, GCH, that's unchanged. The hash code will fit into 2 bits. this is going to be a very bad hash code. No, 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 we will deal with this. And you still have the class pointer up there. What's the problem with all this? In the current situation, we have two words. In the first word, it rarely carries any interesting information. So it might carry hash code information, but it only usually happens for few objects. It may carry locking information, but only very few objects ever get locked on the heap. So we basically waste this word on stuff that is rarely used. And in the second word, we have this class pointer, which is very crucial information for any object, because we need this for all sorts of things. If we don't have this, then this object doesn't have a type identity, which is, we may not do this. So this is part of the problem. In the new world, this class pointer is part of the header, which means that suddenly this header is has crucial information that we must not lose, and we always need for things like figuring out the object size or something like this. So we must never lose that class pointer there. And also, this header displacement that I talked about earlier means that how do we access this information when we need to follow through to the actual mark word? Those are the three problems: how to fit everything into fewer bits, how to safely access this mark word, and how to avoid losing the class pointer to begin with. I don't have all that much time, so I can only scratch the surface of these problems. I will give a very high-level overview of this. The first is locking. When locking happens, then, let's look at one example. Stack locking is the most lightweightest locking in Hotspot. It's really just a compare and swap thing on the object header. This was too fast. Let's go back a little bit. So it coordinates threads by comparing and swapping on the object header. I said this. It doesn't. As soon as contention happens, we inflate this stack lock to an object monitor. It doesn't support wait notify. It doesn't support JNI. And any of this happens, we inflate this to what we call a full object monitor. This is why we have those two different locking modes. The way that works now is when that happens, the JVM does a compare and swap on the object header, and it basically exchanges the current header with a pointer to the stack, and it sticks the original mark word somewhere on the stack. And this is how we can basically find the original mark word and restore it when we unlock. Then we do the opposite thing and swap it around. It does answer the question, is this thread locked by object E? By this object, it cannot answer the question which thread is currently locking this object, because it's not really necessary. In Lilliput, the way we solve that is, and I have only one slide of this, which is quite amazing, because I basically rewrote the locking implementation there for this. But what we do there is, instead of putting the original mark word on the stack and putting a pointer on this location in the mark word, we basically turn this around and say, okay, let's have a small lock stack, what would we call it, lock stack, and we basically only push the object on that lock stack, and then we still do a compare and swap to flip a single bit here, but nothing else. The rest of the mark word stays intact. It still answers the same question, is this thread T locking this object, and nothing else. So this is the very scratch the surface overview of this stack locking. I cannot go deeper because time is running out. I need to hand over to you, right, at this point.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah, let's look at monitor locking. It's a very similar situation. Oracle engineers are currently working on a solution for that. Basic idea is to, instead of doing the mapping from an object to the object monitor through the header, we have a side table and do the mapping there, and then this means that we don't have this header displacement anymore. Also, only scratching the surface on GC forwarding. The GC needs to store, or some GCs need to store forwarding information in the object header. This is used by those full GCs here. And 0 GC, G1 GC, and Shenandoah, they use the header to store forwarding information. And this means that when that happens, we would lose this class pointer and this crucial information. This is because this is why this is a big problem here. For normal operation, it is not such a big deal, because there we have copying GCs, where we first create a copy of the object and then stick the forwarding pointer only in the old copy, which means that in the new copy, we still have all this information, and we can follow through to this new copy to get to the class pointer. The full GC, because it has no space to copy the object, it slides the objects down to the bottom, and in the process of this, would lose this class information. The parallel GC has a different solution here, based on the idea, let's not store this forwarding information in the header, let's always recompute this in some clever ways. And this is basically the plan for what we want to do for the other GCs too. ZGC doesn't have this problem because they don't do full GCs. And with that, well, we have a JEP 450. We have this new lightweight locking is already in JDK 21. The flag to enable this when you grab a build from Alexi or some other place is this flag. And I think with this, I'm handing over to Thomas. You want to talk about the class pointers.
Oh, you mentioned. Oh, okay. Does this work? Oh, it works. Wonderful.
Yeah, okay. Let me switch it. Class pointers and... Wait.
I'm going to start. Yeah. Okay, I'm Thomas. I work at Red Hat. And I'm going to talk about what we do for class pointers in Lilliput. This will be a very quick dive because I only have 10 minutes and this is a bit of a challenge. This is just but one of many moving parts in the Lilliput project. Lilliput is really a real community project in the sense that many companies contribute. And this is the part we decided to tackle at Red Hat. And with that, let's start. Time's ticking. So class pointer. The class pointer currently in the Lilliput project is 32 bits, and that's way too much. We need it to be smaller. It takes up like half of the whole space of the 64-bit Lilliput object header. And so, okay, that's pretty self-explanatory. So some background first. When we load up a class, a Java class, we build up a whole range of companion data structures in native memory. And the centerpiece of this group, and kind of the big boy among them, is the class structure written with K. It's a variable-sized structure ranging from 400 bytes to, I don't know, we saw 5 megabyte monsters at Amazon, but that's rare. And every object's header refers to the class structure of its class. That's why the shape of this reference really matters, because for one, obviously, footprint, and because also we need to be able to dereference it very quickly. Going from object to class is a hot path. So we could just store the native class pointer in the object header, but we usually don't do this because it's 64-bit, way too big. So since a long time ago, we already employ this optimization where we split the native pointer into two parts, a 32-bit offset that refers to a 64-bit runtime constant base, and we only store the offset, and that's what we call the narrow class pointer. And that trick only works if we are able to confine all class structures within a 4 gigabyte range, obviously. And that's exactly what the class space is for. That's the only reason it exists. And we also have CDS. So CDS contains class data sharing. CDS archives contain pre-baked class structures. And so what we do usually is we map the CDS archive very close to the class space such that both are engulfed by the class encoding range. And every class structure in either region can be reached by a narrow class pointer. Okay, and so decoding is basically just an addition. I'm a bit simplifying because of time reasons. So, and the nice thing is,